It is May Bank Holiday Monday. You are listening to Wild Time with myself, Thomas Janak, the Animal Rights / World Conservation Show. I'm on my way to the Royal College of Physicians on Kildare Street just to attend a public meeting. And in this public meeting, the arguments against carted deer hunting with hounds will be presented. Well, I personally think, you know, how odd is it to present arguments against hunting when hunting these days is not by any means a necessity, just causes suffering for the animals involved, and in my book can't even be seen as a sport. So anyway, I'm interested, of course, in finding out what the arguments against are, and maybe, who knows, there might be pro hunting people, and I want to find out then if they're there. Why do you think that in the 21st century we should still be hunting?
Someone's just putting a question forward to veterinary surgeon Finbar Heslin. Have a listen to this.
You clearly have a huge problem with the Kane and Guthrie report, both in its science and the methodology that's been applied to it. Do you think that other professionals, other veterinary professionals within the community would agree with you? And if so, why haven't they come out against this report and rubbished it?
I think there might be a kind of generational split in veterinary. I mean, when I was in college all those years ago, we were just talking about animal welfare as a science at that stage. I can't answer why other vets haven't come out and criticised this. It was extremely difficult to get your hands on this report in the first place. The methodology is, you know, to think that this practice has gone on for probably 12 years, possibly on the basis that the government accepted the science, given that is a little bit scary. So you have to ask other vets what they think about it. But I would think, I mean, I just find it bizarre that a government department would base any decision on blood tests. It's like somebody, the IOC, ringing up Michelle de Bruin and saying, look, we're going to come around next week. Can you have a bit of urine ready for us to analyse? It's ridiculous. And, you know, if you look at some of the English reports, 64, 70 animals tested at a time. They're proper scientific reports. This wasn't.
Okay, and I know we had a question here. I'll come back to you in the Q&A.
Finbar, you mentioned in your speech there about the fact that the Ward Union were claiming that, I think a figure you said, 1.5 million is brought to the local community by their ludicrous activities. Have you any idea what this 1.5 million euro figure is based on? And secondly, would you have any idea of what you think it might be closer to?
I mean, there are analyses done in England on the economics impact of the ban that they were proposing at that stage. There were two big financial studies done in the UK. One of them concerned about the 20s in Wales. And off the top of my head, I think they accounted for about £40,000 sterling to the local economy back in 1999 and 1998. The Burns report cited another financial study because at the time there was an inference that if hunting was banned, that the government could be sued for loss of earnings. And again, the figures that they came up with, I think of there was 320 hunts registered in the UK. They reckoned that they contributed about £14 million sterling to the economy, which would kind of give you a rough idea, maybe 48,000, 49,000 sterling. What's kind of, I'm sure if they stop paying really prestige for the PR consultants, maybe they wouldn't be claiming such. I'd love to know, like a lot of the things that come out of Rise is to say, prove it. Let's see it. Let's see where that money comes from. Let's see where that money goes.
Okay, Finbar, thanks very much.
So let's move swiftly on to Professor William Binchy. He is a professor of law at TCD, and this is his speech.
Now, it's an honour really to be on the same platform as such distinguished people who have spoken to you. And I think, you know, in their different perspectives, they brought things that are very important for our reflection. This is a very simple issue, but behind this simple issue, there's a lot of complex questions that go to the core of what we are, who we are, what does it mean to be a human being, and what is our relationship with the animal world and the wider environment. These are about as important questions as anybody can ask themselves, and they do deserve important reflection and consideration. However, the issue that we have today about the proposed legislation seems to me to be a tremendously simple one, in the sense that I think what we've seen on the film in that beautiful Meath countryside, isn't it amazing how you can have such a beautiful environment in which acts that are not beautiful can take place? In that beautiful environment, as we heard, the science that was delivered to us from Finbar, do we need science to tell us that chasing a stag for 63 minutes or 2 hours or 3 hours causes unnecessary suffering to the stag? It's, I think, really so clear that it would be very hard on that simple proposition, which is a test in law, the test of the 1911 legislation, unnecessary suffering, causing unnecessary suffering. Unquestionably, there's suffering. Where is the necessity in these circumstances? It's a gratuitous act which human beings do cause unnecessary suffering. It is as simple as that. All other questions, I would respectfully say, are secondary to that. The question of the economic dimension, the question of social history, these arguments have been put really for as long as there has been an attempt through legislation and through the legal process to control the propensity of human beings to be cruel towards animals. These arguments have been put. As you may well know, Ireland appears to have been the first English-speaking country in which cruelty legislation, anti-cruelty legislation, was initiated in 1635. An act was put forward, a very short piece of legislation, which was designed to do two things. To stop the pulling of, by horses, of ploughs with their tails. That was a practice that apparently was being used widely at that stage. And also the pulling of wool off sheep, just simply plucking the wool off sheep rather than shearing the sheep. That's 1635, and in a couple of sentences, those practices were condemned. It's interesting to notice that the practice of pulling the wool off sheep was simply seen by the legislators as cruel and should be stopped on that basis. The pulling of the ploughs by the horse's tails was seen as cruel, unquestionably, but also damaging to the horse. So there was an independent economic justification given for that. But the sheep were seen, the actual damage to the sheep and the plucking of wool off the sheep was seen as just inherently cruel and a matter of legal prohibition. We do know that Irish people did play a good role in the 19th century in introducing and encouraging the introduction of legislation against cruelty. It was slow, as you know, at the beginning of the 19th century, its pace increased through the 19th century. Relatively little case law, if you go to the law books and look through what the courts have said, relatively little case law on this matter. The reason for that is, practical reason, which is that these cases tend to come before the lower courts and dealt with very much on the evidence in the case. So there isn't really usually a big legal issue that would come to the higher courts. But there was a case in 1891, which is interesting, a case called McDonough's case, which came up into the Queen's Bench Division. And it didn't involve the kind of cruelty we're talking about, but it involved the question of what they call dishorning, or perhaps we would say dehorning cattle, in the Meath area, interestingly, again. And the question was dehorning cattle in the ways they did it in the late 19th century, was this a cruel practice? There have been previous cases on this going different ways in Ireland and England and Scotland. The magistrates who had this case were clearly of the view that it was not a cruel practice, and they sent the case to the Superior Court, the Queen's Bench Division, on what's known as a case dated, asking the Queen's Bench Division, was dehorning cattle a cruel practice? Now, it's a case that's worth reading if you're interested in the history of cruelty to animals, because the court, a number of judgments were delivered, and it's very interesting capturing, like an X-ray, capturing the kind of cultural and philosophic and religious understandings really that existed in the judges' minds at that particular stage. There were different points of view expressed. They were all of agreement, all the judges were of agreement that it was not cruel to dehorn cattle in these circumstances. But it's interesting noting the different levels of emphasis and the different rationalizations that were given. Conscious that I'm only going to be speaking to you for 5 minutes or so, but I'll give you just a summary of the points that might be worth looking at if you do see that case. The economic dimension was clear in this case. namely that the beef trade and the cattle trade is important in Ireland. The dehorning facilitated transport to England. That's worth noting. One of the judges, the Chief Justice, referred to animals being given to us, essentially for economic purposes, very much that notion of animals as being the property of human beings, and if the economic rationalisation is possible, that is fine. Two of the judges did express concerns that this was a cruel practice. All of it had to be justified on the basis of that it was not wanton, gratuitous cruelty. And when we think of what we're talking about today, the question of taking the stag out and subjecting it to that 1 hour, 2 hours, or 3 hours of essential terror from the stag's point of view, that is clearly something that was not before their consideration in this case. But one of the judges did talk about the changing views of what constitutes cruelty. And just for the next 3 or 4 minutes, or 2 or 3 minutes, just in my closing, I'd just like to talk about that a little bit and raise wider issues, if I may, with you. Because if you will allow us to move to an area where Mary, who's now the Minister for Human Rights, and we're delighted that she is the Minister for Human Rights, where Mary is concerned, if we think of the development of human rights thinking over the last, say, 50 or 60 years, and indeed human rights language and philosophy, even though of course it traces its origins back millennia, the discourse of human rights is really only 2 generations old. It really is only since the United Nations was founded that the kind of discourse that we're used to, of human rights discourse, has been around. But in human rights, on practical questions such as, is hanging a cruel treatment or punishment? Is corporal punishment of children a cruel practice? These are very practical questions. Are prison conditions, like slopping out, do they constitute cruel practices? There's a lot now of international jurisprudence, international case law, on the notion of cruelty and inhumanity. And what is very clear from this case law at the United Nations level, in the European Court of Human Rights, and then at different court levels in various constitutional cases that have occurred in a number of countries, is that everywhere it is accepted that the notion of cruelty is on a momentum, and that what was perceived to be cruel, perceived to be acceptable, I should say 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 20 years ago, on the basis of a momentum in cultural understanding of cruelty has changed, so that we can now say that corporal punishment is a cruel practice, in a way which certainly, in my experience, would not have been said when I was growing up. I should note with a certain amount of regret that times have changed in this area. So we do notice the notion of a momentum moving towards a greater sensitivity and a greater rejection of certain, as I say, practices as cruel. We also, I think it's fair to say, a changing, this is within the human context, a changing appreciation of the, and Joe was mentioning this, a changing appreciation of the abuse of power. Surely anybody who's thought about Ireland in the last 50 years has thought about the abuse of power, and the, not just the disparity of power, but the abuse by those who are powerful over the weak. And we now have greater sensitivity. It's not suggesting for a second that all is wonderful in Ireland or around the world, but we have greater sensitivity to the potential for the abuse by the powerful of the weak. And it doesn't require a huge effort to make a transposition from human interrelationship to the relationship between humans and animals, and then a wider interrelationship between human beings and the environment, to realise that power imbalances, of course, occur in the animal context, human-animal relationships, and that cruelty, even the kind of unknowing cruelty that John was talking about, where good people, people like you and me, perhaps you and me, engage in cruel acts without necessarily being driven by cruel motivation, but nonetheless, because of the culture in which we experience our lives, we don't, if you like, we're not waking to the cruelty which our actions involve. So there's a wider debate taking place there. John also, just in my concluding remarks, John talked about the even wider context, which we shouldn't ignore, but which is mercifully not required for resolution today, the wider context about what it is to be human. Are we transcendent? What does that mean? How do we understand notions that would have been expressed traditionally in religious concepts? One of the great powerful notions, I believe, in human rights is the notion of human dignity, the notion of the equal worth and importance of every human being. That's a tremendously revolutionary notion. As you know, there's a wide debate taking place about animals' rights and the relationship between humans and animals in rights discourse. Maybe we might talk about that at a later stage. But it is worth noting that that debate is taking place. And as a person who would very much support human rights, and would also support human responsibilities and human harmony between human beings and between human beings, animals, and the wider environment, I would be utterly in favour of the legislation. And I would see it, frankly, I could not see the strength of any argument against it, to be frank. There is a wider debate taking place, and amongst the stones that are thrown sometimes by opponents of this type of legislation is a stone which raises those wider issues.
So the sound quality isn't the best. You're listening to Wild Time, the Animal Rights / World Conservation Show with myself, Thomas Yannick, coming to you today from the Royal College of Physicians. This is May Bank Holiday Monday. There is a public meeting addressing the arguments against carted stag hunting with hounds.
I'm now making my rounds to do some interviews, and I'm spotting Laura Broxton and her friends there from NARA, the National Animal Rights Association. So, let's get over there.
I was absolutely sure that you would be here. first thoughts?
Well, I think it was great. I think it's a pity more people didn't turn up, but it was a great opportunity to have this presented to the media and highlighted, and I hope that the ban goes through as soon as possible.
Yesterday, I hope.
Absolutely.
What's coming up with you guys?
Oh, well, we're like protesting week in, week out. By the end of the month, we hope to be going back to Mayo, Charles Rivers Laboratories, to protest the animal testing facility there. We hope to be going down as well, protest a horse race, a bunch of things coming up. Keep an eye on the circuses as well, as well as our regular campaigns, foie gras for Trinity College, McDonald's,
yeah,
everything.
Yeah,
the whole
Brilliant, thanks. What made you come here today?
Oh, it's just to listen to the legislation that's going to pass, yeah. So just to have an idea.
Yeah. Animal rights activists, so yeah. we're interested in that matter.
Okay.
Yeah.
And are you with a group or are you just sort of individual activists?
Okay. Liberation from Dublin.
It's about time that we have bigger things going on in Dublin, isn't it? I just noticed this when they had a day for animals in laboratories, you know, in London and stuff.
Yeah.
And I walked through towns and like, where are the guys? Not one poster, not nothing, you know.
From you, yeah.
Here in Dublin. It's really bad, you know, the way we sort of always are behind in a way.
But for me, this is not the view of the group, but my view, there's one day for this, there's one day for that in the year. It doesn't really represent the way I work. Like, for me, it should be every day. A lot of people, for example, do nothing all year, and you have the vegan day, so everybody bakes cakes and do one thing, and then nothing for the whole year, and then I would prefer people to not actually count on a day in the year to actually do something more every day. I would like people.
I also think, that's absolutely right what you're saying, because if you want to change perceptions, then you have to do it every day.
Yeah.
I mean, I take it we're all vegans here.
Yes. Yeah.
So, in a sense, you're all doing it, and I do it every day.
Yeah.
But even people in the family say, Jesus, here he goes again with the vegan stuff. So it's very difficult to change awareness because we're so conditioned into eating meat.
I think we have to make veganism as easy as possible and as positive as possible. You know, so for me, I see it really like this, talking to the people around. And
get an awareness of it, the better it probably is. Thank you so much. May I ask you, for Irish Radio, what made you come here today?
Because I'm against all cruelty to animals, bone fox hunting, coursing, stag hunting, and other cruelty to domestic animals.
Mm. And then, it was certainly interesting, but we know from experience that everything that has to do with animals takes ages for them to be changed, so it really can be quite frustrating, in a sense.
Listen, who'd go out and hunt a stag and chase them to that extent today? Yeah. It was absolutely cruelty.
Even watching it, I was asking myself the same question, who would want this? But apparently,
look
at the people.
They're savages. They're savages. That's the only way I can describe them. Mm.
What always is a bit for me sort of the depressing is that animal cruelty is an indicator crime. We know, you know, the police even knows that people that are cruel to animals do not stop there. So it needs to be stopped. Also for the sake of if people said, let's say, like, you know, I mean, I would be one of the guys that says, you know, we're all animals, you know, in a way. But there are people that think humans are different. But even from that point of view, in order to protect yourself, you have to stop being cruel to animals.
Well, know? If you're cruel to animals, you're cruel to humans. Now, I'm not cruel to animals, and I'm not cruel to humans. And I think that's the way it should be.
Hi there, how are you guys? I heard you speaking there, and I know they have cut you short a bit. My name is Thomas. If you have a minute for me, just to sort of make that point again that you were trying to make when they were cut you short about the fox hunting and you being a farmer.
Yes, I am. But we have to protect our animals. And these people have no authority to come into our land. They say always, you know, that the farmer gives them permission. The farmer don't give them permission. And they don't ask. Because if they asked, they wouldn't get in. They wouldn't get permission. Yeah, yeah. Who wants his fences broke down, his barbed wire cut, his sheep and his cattle chased, maybe out into somebody else's, like that, in the winter time? And even when they come near slatted units now at farmers, the cattle go mad in the slatted units, and they let pens and everything, and they injure themselves. And then we have a problem then, getting a vet in to administer something to them. Now, when we send a bill, they won't pay it. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, you see, like the man here in North County Dublin rang me one morning to say that 70 horses had gone up through his cauliflower field. And I said to him, well, bring them to court. He said, do you know, he said, that half the Dublin judiciary are gone up through my field, he said.
That's the problem, isn't it?
Because the fact that the legal profession are involved so much with them, and they have a long arm, they're able to do it, like with IFA at the present time. The chairman of the Kildare Hunt is editor of the Farmers' Journal, and he won't publish anything that I print for it.
Of course, yeah.
I'm a former county chairman of IFA, and there was 22 years in different committees for Kilkenny in Dublin. And we brought in these rules and regulations, but IFA won't police them. And then, of course, in order to establish this Irish Countryside Committee, there was 35,000 given as a donation to IFA if this committee would be established. Now, the thing about this committee, I objected to it, but they said, oh, this committee won't be elected by members of IFA at all, so it won't be able to speak for IFA. And yet they come on the spring of the year, and above in County Meath, they publicly declared on the local paper, the Meath Chronicle, I think it was, I have the cutting at home, that the Ward Union and IFA were going against John Gormley. So where are you going? You see, the problem is they have taken the 30 pieces of silver and sold the farmer down the Swanee. So IFA is not credible anymore on that line. Do you know what I mean? Much the same as the Irish Cream and Milk Supplier president the other day went along and sided with this rise, this new organisation that has been formed, that is scaremongering, really. On my farm, I have a fishing club that I allow fishing in the river, no problem. There's a gun club locally that do us a service insofar as that a lot of the tillage men, when they have problems in the fall of the year with crops that are lodged and that type of thing, and weather is difficult, and crows or whatever, pigeons come in, and they can go through a half a field in about a week, do you know what I mean, to decimate the crop. Now, the local gun club, the local gun club in that position have told us that they'll do the shooting to keep out the birds from it and protect the crop. So we're all in favour of them. Now, all of those now with new legislation involved and new negotiations I was involved in it years ago because of the fact that one man got shot on another man's land, on a farmer's land, and he brought the farmer to court. Now, at present now, every member of the fishing club and every member of the gun club has to have two insurance. He has to have a personal injuries and a third party. So they have that now, and they all have to be members of that, and a farmer can challenge them for it at any time, and they have to produce it. So we're quite safe with these people. What is their objection? Why do they join with Rise at all? Because the very man they have to go out and go onto his land or onto his river to fish or to shoot has to be his friend. Why are they going with the enemies of the farmer, the very people that destroy our enterprise? Under EU legislation, we have to have stock-proof fences to keep disease spreading from one farm to another. We have to have barbed wire electric fences. And when the hunt comes in, you can imagine, under EU rules we have these regulations, which cost every farmer money and time, labour and intensive to do this. And when he has it done, the government allows 100 horses to come in and tear down his fence, cut his barbed wire, cut his electric fences. We can't get them to pay because they know that we can't go to court because they have the judiciary in their, on their side. And they know we can't go to court with them. The only thing we can do legally, because we have a vermin license and we can shoot dogs that are terrorising our animals, we can shoot the dogs. What do we recommend? That every member of our farming society, every farmer in the country, you know, the only way he can stop the hunt is shoot their dogs. I don't think that's a solution, and I don't want to shoot dogs anymore, but somebody has to wake up someplace. If we, under EU legislation, have to do all this good fencing, good farming, healthy farming thing, at least government should support us in that. Mm. And like, this is costing ourselves, farmers of the country, money to put in this fencing. It costs the state money to support us in doing it, and the EU, because the grants come from both places. Are we to say that every TD in the Dáil is telling us to be, have produced good food and all the rest, and then allowing these people come in and destroy all the infrastructure that was granted, aided, to be there? Where is the sense of all that? And then these people won't do anything to ban these people. Now, there's quite a logical explanation to the whole thing and solution to the whole thing, and that is drag hunting on their own land, and then it's contained within their own land. Between, there are people with horses around the country, and they have an industry on their own. But I don't allow my cattle out in somebody else's. Why should they allow their horses out in some other person's land? You might have a garden in the city. Now, if somebody came in and broke down your fence,
you wouldn't make it out.
Well, dig up your lawn, pull up your flowers, and run your cattle. She lost her kittens. You would regard that as a criminal offence.
Naturally.
And that's what the hunt is doing. Mm. They're criminally responsible for the damage to a farmer's property. And yet, when we bring it to court, it's dismissed. Because the judge is probably running with some hunt. And this is what we have to break up.
Yeah. And can I talk to you about farming as such? Yes. Apparently, you know, seeing it progressively over the years.
Yes.
With the United Nations now coming out and saying that 50% of the greenhouse gases are actually caused by farming. So probably in the next 10, 15 years, there will be changes, or there has to be changes, to farming. Would you be in favour of farming plant-based stuff, or if it is animal-related?
Well, you see, the problem is, as regards animals, there's a certain amount of the earth that can be tilled, a certain amount of it cannot, and that is ideal for animal production. And that feeds a lot of people. We're well fed in Europe for the simple reason that we have the money to buy the food from halfway around the world. Now, South America produces a lot of food. Now, they should send that into Africa, but African people, where there's starvation. But the African people can't buy it. But they'll send it in here to an already sufficient market. But because we have money, they'll trade with us. So we are overfed, and then most of Africa is underfed. So there's that distinction. Now, as regards animals that are there, they say there's greenhouse gases from belching and farting or whatever you like to call it, in that line.
Yeah.
Now, the same thing happens to humans, and the more humans in the world than there is animals, what do we do?
When you look at it scientifically, they may have a point. They wouldn't really necessarily bring it out. Like, I think one of the things that the United Nations is actually saying is that if we would feed, we're talking about Africa here. If we would feed the grain directly that we feed to the animals, there would be no starvation. That's what they're saying. I'm just saying what they're saying.
Yes, so there are so many people, and there are so many areas in the world, you see, that cannot be tilled. Hmm. You know, there are hills and there are mountains and things like that, and we can graze animals on them. Are we to leave these idle? and go for all tillage. Now, if we went to all tillage and all crops like that are grown, there wouldn't be enough land in the world, enough production off that land to feed the existing population. Mm. So you'll have to, you know, there's quite an amount of animals eaten in the Western world. So how are you going to replace that?
That would be the thing, that because we talked about the government here.
Yes.
Logically, I mean, if I follow the idea of the United Nations, in the sense that there will be changes, yes. Or has to be some changes. If you were to farm plant-based, just say it, you know, you would be willing to. How much do you think compensation is needed to make that happen?
Well, no compensation provided that price is paid for the corn. At present, it's uneconomic to grow corn here in Ireland for the simple reason that in 1978, I got £136 a tonne for barley. They're now getting €90 a tonne for barley. How many years later? Now, with all the cost of production going up in the meantime, wages for everything and that thing, over the time having increased, we're now in a situation where most people now are getting out of tillage, totally, because it's not paying. So how do you reverse that? Now, as well as that, we had a beet industry here, a sugar beet industry. Now, that was taken away from us because a lot of them said that, well, it's too expensive to produce in our economy, because wages are so high and all the rest. So we said, right, okay, and it was taken from us. Now, there's a lot of employment loss because of that. So now it all comes from the Caribbean and other parts of the world, where people are paid in the cane fields, they're paid $1 a day. Now, are we going back to that? Are we going to come? We are already on world price, but there's nobody going to work here for $1 a day.
Mm. I also think that in all reality, you couldn't afford it for $1 a day, with the prices we have to pay here.
That's right.
You know.
But then again, on the other hand, if you bring down the price of everything and wages, everything comes down.
Mm.
But at present, of course, most of the things, even everything at the present time, even I was told the other day that some of the English, the famous English crockery is now being made in China. Okay. And a lot of the books that are produced, because I'm chairman of a local heritage society, we produce quite a number of books in the area on the history of the area. And we find now that when it comes to it, it would be much cheaper to have the book produced in China.
Mm.
And of course, you know, as well as that too, a lot of the men that were in the buildings and all the rest, are bringing in, of course, stone from China, granite, all that type of thing, because it's cheaper to do there. So we're losing jobs out of China wholesale. So the likelihood of we having full employment needs a drastic reform of the whole system. So whether
which is difficult, done, yeah, that's
you know what I mean. Yeah. So that we're in the middle of it, but we're already producing at 20. We're down now on 20 cents a litre for milk. It was 40 cents last year. Now that's half of the price of the milk, which is now that makes it under the cost of production.
Mm.
So a lot of farmers now are getting out at the present time. Now, what can substitute that? We say in an agricultural country, I don't know what you're going to do, but farmers are hanging on by the skin of their teeth at the present time.
I noticed when you were talking there, you know, I know we all have to go here. Do you genuinely also care about the deer? You know, you were saying about your land and stuff.
Of course I do. And look, don't anybody tell you this much about farmers. Farmers care about their stock, if only for the fact that an animal that's cared for well will fatten well and will leave you money. And you cannot, if it doesn't pay to feed, it certainly doesn't pay to starve. So you look after your animals. Always a policy in our place, we talk to the cows. Now there's what? 80, 90 cows in it. But I'd always talk in general to them and all the rest, you know. And as a result, when we are out the fields, if we are changing cattle from one paddock to another, we only call them. Come on, and they'll come after you. And they follow and whatever. And we find that's much better. And if now tomorrow we're doing a TB test on the farm. And when we go out now tomorrow, we go out in the fields of the cattle, we say, come on, new paddock. They won't know they're going to, but they come in the yard and we can test them, and it's much handier than anything else. But you have to care for your animals.
I'm just asking this because obviously there's this big debate, and usually, see, my show is an animal rights show, so I rarely get to speak to a farmer as such, because farmers usually say, oh, Jesus, it's not an animal rights guy, don't even talk to him, because we have a stigma, you have a stigma. So that's why it's so important to say that. But given this tendency of people to say, like, you know, maybe in this world where I can, in the Western world where I can make choices, I might go vegan and have no dairy and no things, and then there are even books that scientifically recommend it. I'm just saying what's out there, okay? So my question is, where does it leave you as a farmer, and do you understand the concept of people saying to you, look, I want nothing to do with it?
Well, there's no problem with that. What you put in your own belly is your own choice. Do you know what I mean? But personally, now I love the bit of beef.
I understand that. But basically, what I'm saying is, if the tendency is to go vegan and to say, I'm just saying it, you know, that would also mean that the price for your milk, not only would you sell less, potentially, I'm just talking about potentially, so it would always be more difficult over the years now I mean, I'm not saying this happens tomorrow. What I'm saying is that there is a tendency, and they say in the UK there's 5,000 more vegetarians / vegans a day. So it is apparently something that you probably will have to think about in 20 years' time.
Not really, because half the world is starving. Now, if everybody was fed in this world, there wouldn't be any surplus any place. But you see, these people can't afford to buy. It's an economic thing. Those that are on top are keeping the rest down. And like, really and truly, there are a lot of governments in Africa. And if you look at the television, you'll see the answer there to a great degree. If you look, you see they all have a little bit of a war going on. Maybe a civil war or whatever. They all have that. And the next thing is, they'll show you photographs of this. And they're young chaps, 14, 12, 14, maybe younger, sporting a large piece of machine gun. And there are bandoliers of bullets around his neck. And they can afford arms. And that chap hasn't a bit in his stomach. So where's the logic? Do you know what I mean? The Western world will provide arms,
but also
no food.
But also, you know, I mean, in Europe we are throwing away food.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
So I think, you know, logically this can't be answered, because there isn't. May I ask you your name?
My name is Philip Lynch. I'm chairman of Farmers Against Fox Hunting and Trespass.
I think I got your little flyer there.
Yes, you did.
You know?
Yes.
Thank you so much. Well, that's really all we have time for. You're listening to Wild Time, the Animal Rights / World Conservation. You're with myself, Thomas Janak. We'll be back soon.